When Jesus wore,
from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about how a high fruit intake during our adolescent years is linked with a lower breast cancer risk, Oxford University in the United Kingdom. Then how fruit, specifically two fruits, are able to provide new treatments for type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease, University of Warwick, also in the United Kingdom. And then a sixth sense protects drivers except when texting, University of Houston. And working memory is better after a barefoot run. I was watching some people do a barefoot run, and they were doing it out in a desert out west. It's rough on the feet, but I certainly understand its benefits because I used to run every morning barefoot in the sands on the beach down at Miami, and you feel great. Now there's a science behind that, and I'll explain what that is. Cabbage can reduce your risk of cancer. Then we're going to not have a guest today because I wanted to do a look at different issues and give you some input on them. For example, when we talk about or hear people talking about all the benefits that we gave to the Afghan citizens for invading their country, one we left out, oh, it's not a benefit except to those who profit from it. It's turned an entire generation of children into heroin addicts. We'll talk about that. Also, I gave you an input yesterday from Reverend Farrakhan on Hillary Clinton. Today, I'm giving you another. This is Anise Shivani. Clinton's policies have hurt women. A real feminist talking about a faux feminist who is supported by radicalized polemists and no spiritual feminist. And gives them a lowdown. Think you'll appreciate this. Also, if you've ever been to London, and you really should because it's one of the most magnificent cities in the world to visit, especially those parts that have not been altered. They're still there from antiquity. And Hyde Park has a corner, Speaker's Corner, where individuals can get up on this little soapbox and talk. And sometimes there's no one there to listen to them, and sometimes there's little crowds. I've listened many times to people who were, you know, orating on some topic, and I'm going to have you listen to a man named Ishmael. He's a street orator, and he is speaking frankly on hip-hop and the black youth culture in a way you do not hear spoken about in the United States. You'll hear a lot of little bleeps because he's using a lot of vulgarity. And since we have to appreciate the sensibilities of many of the stations that syndicate this program, we have edited those, but you'll still get his meaning, which is unedited. It's full force. And then I'll give my own commentary on that. Let's begin, as we have a really packed show today for you. First up, we know we should be eating more fruits. In fact, the more fruits we eat, the healthier we're going to be, and every single study shows that. But two new scientific papers in the British Medical Journal shed light on the relation of alcohol and diet with breast cancer and heart disease. And the first study reports that high fruit consumption shows a lowered breast cancer risk, especially if you're a teenager, and that's important. And also, if you begin to drink alcohol, you're going to have a substantially increased risk of breast cancer later in life. Now, fruit and vegetables are thought to protect against breast cancer. There are at least 200 studies in the peer-reviewed literature that prove that. But it's the fruits that make a big difference. The question is, how long does it take to show that impact? And what we're finding now, it might be 20 years. So if you're in your midlife and you don't have breast cancer and you've been eating a lot of fruit, that fruit probably helped protect you from breast cancer. So a team of U.S. researchers wanted to see whether fruit and vegetable consumption might affect subsequent breast cancer. They followed 90,000 nurses for 20 years, and they found that the higher the fruit consumption, meaning about 2.9 servings a day and a serving's a cup, was associated with a 25% lower risk of breast cancer diagnosis in middle age. Now, mind you, that did not take into account other things we know lower the breast cancer rate, like vitamin C, vitamin D, lower your breast cancer risk. A chlorophyll lowers your breast cancer risk. Cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, collard greens, kale, mustard, cabbages, watercress, lower your breast cancer risk. This is just fruits. So now you see why some women could go through their whole life with no chance of breast cancer because of what they're consuming. And the greater consumption of specific fruits, what are the top three? Apples, bananas, and grapes. And then right behind that was oranges. So that's what helps. And that was from Oxford University. Then another study done at the University of Warwick, also in the United Kingdom, showed that a combination of two compounds found in red grapes and oranges could improve the health of people with diabetes and reduce heart disease. And that's good. Quote from the study from the Professor Tomalley. This is an incredibly exciting development and could have a massive impact on our ability to treat these diseases. As well as in helping to treat diabetes and heart disease, it could diffuse the obesity time bomb. And the research entitled Improved Glycemic Control and Vascular Function in Overweight and Obese Subjects by Glyoxylase 1 Inducer Formation, that was published in Diabetes. I give you that because sometimes the doctors, nurses, scientists in the audience, dietitians, would like to reference a study. Now you can. But it comes down to this for everyone else. When you consume grapes, you're getting what is called trans resveratrol. That's found in red grapes. And you're also getting what is called hesperitin, H-E-S-P-E-R-E-T-I-N, found in oranges. So when you give them both together, you're getting a terrific amount of these nutrients, and these impact your blood sugar levels and also help your heart. So grapes and oranges help your heart and help you with diabetes. This is from the University of Houston. Quote, while much has been made about the dangers of texting and driving, less attention has been focused on the age-old distractions of being absent-minded or upset while driving. A team of research in the University of Houston and Texas A&M focused on all three of these important factors. And the study looked at what happens when people drive the same segment of highway four times under normal conditions of being focused on driving, while distracted with cognitively challenging questions, while distracted with emotionally challenged and charged questions, and while preoccupied with texting trivialities. To avoid bias, the order of the drives was randomized. In all three interventions, absent-minded, emotional, and texting, the researchers found that the driver's handling of the wheel became jittery with respect to normal driving. This jittery handling resulted in significant lane deviations, unsafe driving, and so. Here's the key. Here's the takeaway message. I'm sure all of you have experience while driving. You suddenly catch yourself and you look around thinking, wow, where was I for the last minute or two? And when we fall into deep thought, when we are distracted by conversation, when we're angry about something or frustrated or stressed, we're not giving our full and undivided attention to driving. Throw in texting. And even when it's an audio port, meaning you're not physically texting, you're verbally texting, which you can now do, that really puts you in jeopardy and others. So what's the best thing to do? Just drive without all the distractions where possible. If you're a parent, you got kids and a dog, and everyone's yelling and screaming because you're going someplace, understand that that's a challenge. But the more you focus upon what you're doing, the safer your driving will be. And from the University of North Florida, barefoot running is better than running with shoes for your working memory. Now, how about this for all people over the age of 50? That's according to a new study. The experiment designed by lead researcher was from the Department of Psychology and working memory. By the way, that's our ability to recall and process information. And we need that every day. So by improving it, we're able to realize gains in key areas, from schoolwork to work and retirement. So your working memory is increasingly recognized as crucial for cognitive skill. So just imagine that you had a grassy area or a beach or some place to run where you could be barefoot and not hurt your feet. That is terrific. And it was published in Perceptual and Motor Skills. But here's something else. Just try to be barefoot around your house. It is really better because when you step, the metatarsals are able to splay, meaning the toes will spread out, and that's healthier for the feet. And so barefoot is good. And cabbage is good for reducing your cancer risk. Cabbage is not on anyone's my most exciting thing to eat list, unless you like some of the cabbage stews from Eastern Europe and Ukraine, which they're very good at making. But cabbage is in the same genus family as broccoli and kale. It's a cruciferous. And they have chemicals in them that have been able to block cancer or reverse cancer. And cancer is common in the colon when you don't have enough fiber. So a high-protein diet, high-protein from animal, you have no fiber. Cheese doesn't have fiber. Yogurt and milk doesn't have fiber. Steaks don't have fiber. Chicken doesn't have fiber. So you want the fiber, and that plant-based diet gives you that. Cabbage has a particularly good fiber in it. And that not only breaks down, gives you good probiotics, but also helps protect against colon cancer. In fact, those who ate cabbage had a 29% lower risk of colon cancer. And that is significant. And it's one of the superstars for fighting cancer. And why? Because it contains what is called I3C. I stands for indole, I-N-D-O-L-E, the numeral 3, carbinol, carb, C-A-R, benol, B-I-N-O-L. And that forms byproducts that improve the system to protect against any form of the bad. Let me make it really simple. The bad nutrients are what are called 16-alpha-hydroxyestrione, and that is what you don't want, and 2-hydroxyestrione, and the cruciferous vegetables increase the ratio of 2-hydroxy to 16-hydroxy-alpha-hydroxyestrione, which is associated with a greater protection, whereas meat doesn't give you the alpha, and it gives you greater propensity towards elevated estrogen metabolism, and that can create cancer. And sulforaphane, which like indole-3-carbinol, is formed from glucosinolates when cabbage is chewed, but when you steam the cabbage or you cook the cabbage, like in a cabbage soup, tomato cabbage soup, and throw in the spice to use in tomato cabbage soup, I make a tomato cabbage soup with tomatoes. And how I make my tomatoes is I just dip my whole skin tomatoes in. I take the skin off. I'll use them separately. But then I put the skinless tomatoes, and that makes the whole soup sweet. You add in some olive and coconut oil together, and then onions, and let the onions heat, but the water should never come to a boil. And then add in some diced potatoes, any kind of potatoes, from fingerling to russet are fine. And then you cube the cabbage and put the cabbage in, and some shiitake mushrooms are really good, and then some sliced garlic, some ginger, and that makes a great cabbage stew. What happens is that it all starts to loosen up, and then when you eat the cabbage is able to release its indole-3 carbonyl and its glucosinolates into your system, and the fiber sweeps out the intestine, so it's healthier for you. And kimchi, Kim, K-I-M, C-H-I, is a fermented Korean cabbage dish, and it's good for your health. It's loaded with nice nutrients, and it can reduce the growth of foodborne pathogens such as Listeria, monocytogenes, and Staphylococcus aureus. You have to have a developed taste for it, otherwise you gag. And that's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a listen now to a speaker in England where anyone who has something to say and wants a public forum can get up on this little speaker's corner box and be on their little speaker's box and talk. This man is called Ishmael, and he's talking about hip-hop and black youth culture. Please listen in.
Arnold Schwarz, Pizza Hut, Sharon Stone, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, jazz, hip-hop artists. All of this gives us a relationship with America, but it is a corrupt relationship. It manifests itself in corrupting our moral principles and what we desire and determine for ourselves. Look at sort of, say, black culture. Black global youth culture is dominated by African-American culture. Hip-hop, and not just black culture, youth culture. Hip-hop has now become pop music. So you will have youth in India who like hip-hop, Latin America, Africa, across the globe, youth culture. Look at the artists that purvey the message of hip-hop. They have lost that sort of social commentary. But it's not by accident, it's by design. Those who still continue with social commentary are not getting any record deals. They're not getting promoted. So the black artists like Puff Daddy, Jay-Z, Snoop Dogg, 50 Cent, all of these mad, look at them. The psychology of that is that you have to be real. I'm a real, I killed and killed 10, shot up your black woman. That is part of the DNA now of corporate hip-hop, promoted by the white mainstream, because now the biggest purveyors and buyers of hip-hop is white suburbia. But a white artist could never make that music. Never. They would never promote a white artist to do that. Not even Eminem. Eminem can tell, make a song about his mother, I hate them, but he would never hear Eminem or any white artist, because it would never happen. The government would not allow it to happen. The corporate media censors would not allow it to happen. The record industry execs would not allow it to happen, because they know it would not be endorsed. You would never have a white rapper hip-hop artist or Eminem or any of them walking around saying, I just shot up, I killed Ashley 9 times. Hey, you white, hey, you white. It would never happen. Never happen.
Yeah,
do you understand me? Hold up. So they control that message. And so when they've got their Glastonbury's and party in Hyde Park, they bring over the Jay-Z's, the Snoops, the Puff Daddies, and all of these clowns to sell you black, the representation of blackness. So when you look at me, the only paradigms of respectable, of understanding the black experience you have, Jay-Z, Puff Daddy, the hip-hop artist. So no wonder when you see a black man, you shuffle your handbag or you think we're selling drugs, because it sells and portrays that same lie. That's why I was so pleased when Barack Obama was elected president. Not that I wanted a black President Obama. Obama's a corrupt devil. Should go. But I like the fact that Barack Obama diluted the one-dimensional narrative that you Europeans have of the black experience. It's a deep...
All right, that's one person's perspective. Now, on TalkBack, I'd like for you to share your perspective. Here is the larger, overarching question. Today, who represents the black culture? The message is the black culture. He's suggesting that it's the black rap artist, and that that message is frequently a message of anger, misogyny, rage. Is it legitimate or not? Does it convey the message of what a black culture is in its multi-diversity? Does it polarize? Now to something that we don't think about. And again, this is part of the intended and unintended consequences of and regime change and going into other people's countries like Afghanistan. This is from Michalia Witten, quote from Activist Post. One of the many catastrophic legacies left behind by the longest war in U.S. history is that Afghanistan produces 90% of the world's opium. As with most parts of the world, the most vulnerable pay the heaviest price of war, and the country has faced a harrowing escalation in the number of children heroin addicts. What's happening in Afghanistan over the past 13 years has been the flourishing of a narco state that is really without any parallel in history. Adding to all those levels of Afghanist society are involved in the flourishing trade, which became undeniably worse after the U.S.-led invasion. They're now accusing the both the Taliban and Afghan government linked to these profiting from the crisis. In fact, it's gotten so bad that Afghanistan now produces twice as much opium as did in the year 2000. And the booming trade now accounts for 50% of the country's gross domestic product. And since the cartels began refining their poppy harvest into addictive and profitable heroin, the street price of heroin is the cheapest in the world, and it costs less than food. And then you end up with the children. The psychological damage of war, together with the flood of cheap heroin, has led to a doubling in addiction rates over the last 5 years. In a Channel 4 documentary called Unreported World, they explore a harrowing escalation in child addiction. In the ravaged country, where access to drug treatment is very limited, what you have is people who are shamed because in their religious beliefs you shouldn't become an addict. But when they are addicted, who do they turn to for help? Quote, the problem is so severe among the children that many are taking desperate measures to fund their habits. Naval spoke to a 13-year-old boy at a safe house who began using when his parents were killed by shelling. From the age of 8, he was paid by drug addicts to guard them while they smoked. Unsurprisingly, he then developed his own habit, which he funds with child prostitution. Many addicted children sell their bodies as there are no jobs or work. 15-year-old Ali has been using heroin for the past 2 years. His mother is dead, and his father fled to Iran. He smoked a gram of heroin, which cost $1, on camera as he explained how he became addicted. The young boy's trauma began when, after witnessing a suicide bomb attack in Kabul, he went to stay with relatives in the countryside. While he was there, U.S. forces bombed his village, killing dozens of people. He described seeing bodies scattered everywhere. The young boy and other villagers had to pick up the body parts and put them in plastic bags, claiming the war breaks his heart and making his descent into drug use more understandable. He said, "I'd rather not live than live through this war." And then it goes on to talk about how many people are addicted. It's a huge number of families have children that are addicted and adults that are addicted. And what do? Well, we watch it. We protect the warlords. And that means that we are participants in this entire debacle. But I want to share this short commentary from Anis Shivani. Quote, "Not liking Hillary has nothing to do with being a woman. It has everything to do with her hyper-masculine values. Hillary is that rare combination, even in our grotesque political landscape, of a smooth-talking neoliberal with the worst tendencies of a warrior neoconservative. You couldn't say that about Bill to the same extent, but there isn't a regime change opportunity, a chemical or conventional arms deal, an escalated aerial or drone war, or an authoritarian friend in need that Hillary hasn't liked. If we get her, we will only be setting back feminism by decades, because her policies, like welfare reform, have always come packaged under the false rubric of caring for women and children. It's like George Bush's compassionate conservatism, the rhetorical cover she needs to enact policies time after time that erode women and children's standing, even as she claims to be their steadfast advocate. It has been disheartening for me to read some female intellectuals, particularly in the New York literary world, rage against any criticism of Hillary. We are told it's only sexism that makes us speak. We'd better check our feminist credentials, they say. Are we who criticize Hillary misogynists? Then why do we have kind words to say for Elizabeth Warren? We've had similar criticisms of Condoleezza Rice, of Sarah Palin, and Carly Fiorello. Carly, for me, was the scariest person running for president this cycle. You felt that poor autistic Ben Carson, if you begged and pleaded with him for your life, just might spare you, but not Carly. Carly even made a virtue of dragging Hewlett-Packard down into the pits, which is not much different than Hillary's indifference to the erosion that occurred in foreign policy during her tenure as Secretary of State, as she failed to move into a more liberal paradigm, insisting on sanctions and other punitive regimes in countries like Iran that disproportionately hurt women. John Kerry, once he took over, quickly picked up the ball that was dropped and achieved diplomatic success on a range of fronts, including climate change, where Hillary had failed. There's a palpable deficit of feminist values in this country's politics. After 16 dark years of surveillance, vigilantism, police controls, economic servitude, and debt, to the extent that we can generalize about feminine and masculine values the country desperately desires, well, two-thirds of it anyway, those besides Trump and Cruz fans, a rejuvenation of feminist values. That means compassion, acceptance, and understanding for those left behind by misguided economic policies. That means valuing once again, as this nation has done for the periods it has shown brightest, imagination, beauty, soft-spokenness, and unexpected generosity. In the early 1990s, Hillary did represent, to some limited symbolic level, a change for the better in terms of feminist values, though this certainly didn't translate into actual policy improvements for women or children or minorities. Rather, the opposite occurred in policies engineered by the Clintons. Furthermore, one could argue that it was George H.W. Bush who promoted the relative humanization of the 1990s after the harsh Reagan-era rhetoric, promising a kinder, gentler nation and aspiring to be the education president and the environmental president. The elder Bush's policies were to the left of either Clinton when it came to imagination, civil liberties, clean air, disability, and many other issues. The Clintons went out of their way to pursue often gratuitously policies that hurt women and children. The re-election seemed safely in their pockets, yet they went ahead anyway with harmful laws on crimes and welfare, telecommunications, immigration, and surveillance, legitimizing right-wing discourse that was to bear full fruit in the following decade. It was the Clintons who set the stage for the massive harm that was to befall women and immigrants and the poor and the elderly and children once they provided liberal cover to social Darwinist ideas that had been swirling around in the maniacal think tanks but had not yet been able to make it through Congress. The Clintons have somehow managed to convince half the sane world that they should be the natural recipients of African-American votes, despite everything they have done when in power to erode the economic security of African-Americans and other minorities. The false hope raised during the 1990s was that the economic boom, itself a mirage, as it turns out, would eventually lead to significant wage gains, but that never happened. Poor minority women and children were drastically hurt by the welfare bill the Clintons so enthusiastically pushed through Congress, and likewise, all the policies from trade to student aid they pursued in the name of fiscal responsibility, in cutting the deficit and the debt, and playing by Wall Street's tune on neoliberal disciplinary virtues. She's a little different than Milton Friedman, the greatest post-war popularizer of the free market mythos, a personal responsibility separating the virtuous from those deserving of sanctions, is as much a credo of her as it was of Reagan, or for that matter, Barry Goldwater. The Global International Monetary Fund, World Bank consensus, the regime of structural adjustment to make developing countries fall into line with the dictate of bankers in the developed world, reached the peak of its authority during the 1990s. Under Clinton's, the so-called Washington Consensus was and remains a nihilistic retort to any type of redistributive policies poor countries might wish to pursue to uplift their people. Is cutting education and wealth, health and care and utility subsidies in the name of balancing budgets to the satisfaction of the global banking elite a feminist value? Yet no one is more responsible than the Clintons for making the withdrawal of government from public services worldwide gospel, at least until some Latin American countries finally started breaking away from the imposition in the 2000s. Though she still likes to present herself as a fighter for women and children's rights, let's keep our sights on Hillary's actual record. When Central American refugee children started streaming over the southern border a couple of years ago, Hillary was quick on the mark to condemn these poor souls to death and oppression. In a 2014 discussion with Christina Amanpour, she refused to say she would allow unaccompanied minors fleeing violence to stay in the country. Instead, she insisted that her message of deterrence that had to be sent to prevent others from thinking of seeking refuge in the United States. And though Bernie Sanders didn't use this example during the last Democratic debate, when it came time to tighten the screws on bankruptcy laws, making it harder for poor people, often women, to escape the burden of unreasonable debt, Hillary was there to do the big financial institutions' bidding. She has always been late to the scene and adopts a placating rhetorical stance on any cutting-edge progressive issue, from gay rights to drug legalization to doing something about mass incarceration, even if her policies have explicitly promoted the regressive attitudes in the first place. She likes to show up when someone else has done the job, to pick up the credit, as she did when she eagerly stood with New York Governor Andrew Cuomo for passage of the $15 minimum wage, something she opposed to it in principle at the national level when she was senator. In any case, incrementally lifting the minimum wage to $15 in different states in 3 to 5 to 7 years is already too little too late. The huge affection shown for Barack Obama in the first 6 months of 2008 was because he came across, rather disingenuously as it turned out, as embodying feminist values. He enunciated an ethics of compassion we had sorely missed during the macho Bush years. All that changed as soon as his nomination was secured, and after June 2008, he had no further interest in holding anyone accountable for the vicious hyper-masculine deeds of the preceding 8 years. Hillary has always undercut feminism by selectively appropriating hyper-feminine tropes when it suits her politically and undermining the ideal of the equality of men and women, including emotional equality. She calls up the tears when necessary, but her entire subtext of her 16 long positioning years is that I pay my dues, especially in terms of emotional cost, so I must have my turn to run. This is not a particularly empowering feminist message. Likewise, to keep repeating the 1 million miles she traveled in 112 countries she visited, the Secretary of State seems a throwback to the pre-feminist notions of backbreaking work for its own sake. She was there. She may not have a record to point to, but she sure showed up and worked her butt off, and therefore, let's elect her. I desperately wish to see a female president. It happened long ago in many other nations, some of which are not even considered developed countries by our reckoning. Sri Lanka, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and many others did it a while ago. Yes, it would be wonderful to have a female president, but it turns out that this time it's Bernie Sanders who comes closest to representing the feminist values of caring, trust, understanding, compassion, peace, and yes, love. I'm Gary Knoll. We'll share more on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone.
Get down, tell me, what you gonna do? Do you wanna get down? What you gonna do? You wanna get out? What you gonna do? You wanna get down? Tell me. By standing on the wall,
get your back up off the wall.
Tell me, how you gonna do it if you really don't wanna dance? By standing on the wall,
get your back up off the wall.
Cause I heard all the